This is the philosophy of Plato, Protagoras, session 17, May 24th, 1965.
Problem, or practical problem. The exam subject, did you take it down? I mean, those of you who plan to undergo the treatment, quote, Socrates' critique of Protagoras' political science, unquote. Now, as a background for this subject, which does not necessarily mean that you should speak about it, but which should somehow be present to your mind, I remind you of a broader question. In what way does the critique of this topic by Plato and also lay the foundation for classical political philosophy, so that you do not think you deal only with a very little question regarding one minor dialogue that this broad question is involved in. Also, as a piece of background, and with this I begin my coherent exposition by which I intend not merely to coach you for the examination, but rather to sum up what we have learned. In the Protagoras we find one of the first references to political science, political technique, which can also mean political art, i.e. that every political scientist must have a certain interest in the first of occurrence of the notion of our science, however much it may have changed its meaning. It is true, the term, and that is perhaps even aggravates the importance, the term is used not by Protagoras, but by Socrates, in order to describe not Socrates' own pursuit, but the pursuit of Protagoras, the most celebrated Sophist. Now, this is in itself not particularly surprising, because if I'm not mistaken, you will find in every textbook now the view that political science, in whatever way it may be understood, is of sophistic origin. The simple schema, the great philosophers prior to Socrates dealt with the cosmos, with the cosmos, and then there came in this time of disintegration, there came up these nasty fellows, the sophists, and they dealt in their way, in a very inept way. Well, there are people today who say in a very good way. There is a book by a man called Havelock, the liberal, how is it called?
Liberal temper in Greek power.
Temper, that's a very good word, because it reminds you of distemper. but the liberal temper in Greek politics, in which he makes the most of this. And he thinks they are practically identical with present day the behavioralists with a pragmatist bent. Good. But we don't, at any rate, it's a very common view that politics are of sophistic origin. Now, therefore, one must raise this question. What is the character of the sophistic political art? And why is it regarded as radically insufficient and defective by Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and all their great followers? The most accessible remark you find, the most simple and straightforward remark, you find at the end, near the end of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, where he says the Sophists reduced, or almost reduced, political science true rhetoric. And that is, you know, that's originatical. The most important and most striking parallel to the passage at the end of the Ethics I found in Xenophon's analysis, the account of his great exploit in Asia, toward the end of the second book. There he speaks of a man who was a pupil of the most famous rhetorician, another general there called Proxenus. And this Proxenus was a very nice man. But he was not very good as a general, because he was good in appealing to the good in the nice soldiers and praising them if they acted nobly. But he couldn't do anything about the bad ones. He simply lacked it. Now Xenophon shows by his whole account that he, who was a pupil of Socrates and not of Gorgias, a rhetorician, could do both, could handle the good as well as the bad. Now, and this is, in order, now, the connection with the end of the rhetoric is this. With the end of the Nicomachean Ethics, I'm sorry, is this. Aristotle makes it clear that rhetoric, speeches, won't be sufficient. You must have laws. And we can say without without any error mistaking Aristotle's meaning, laws with teeth in them. The Sophists believed in the omnipotence of speech, of persuasive speech, and Socrates did not believe it. And this simple commonsensical disagreement of Socrates, because most people would agree with Socrates that speech alone is not sufficient for ruling human beings, is this, however, led it's a germ of a classical public judgment. Forgive me for reading to you my summary of this point in The City and Man, page 29. That cannot be correct. One second. From this we understand why the nature of political things defeats to some extent not only reason, this we all know, that rational policy is to make a decision, but persuasion in any form. And one grasps another reason why the sophistic reduction of the political art to rhetoric is absurd. Xenophon's companion Proxenus had been a pupil of Gorgias, the famous rhetorician. Thanks to Gorgias' instruction, he was capable of ruling gentlemen by means of praise or abstention from praise. If that did something which was not quite. Yet he was utterly incapable of instilling his soldiers with respect and fear of himself. He was unable to discipline them. Xenophon, on the other hand, the pupil of Socrates, possessed the full political art, i.e. both persuasion and the other. The very same thought, the insufficiency of persuasion for the guidance of the many, and the necessity of laws with teeth in them, constitutes the transition from Aristotle's ethics to his politics at the end of the day. It is within this context that Aristotle denounces the Sophist's reduction of politics to rhetoric. And now I draw a conclusion. So far from being Machiavellian, in quotes, the Sophists, believing in the omnipotence of speech, they are blind to the sternness of politics. This is at least the picture we get on the basis of these two important reports. Now, this view that rhetoric as such supplies the solution to the political problem is used of by Plato himself. For example, in the Gorgias, where the true politics is presented as the noble rhetoric, and above all in the Republic, where the key question is, how can one persuade the city to accept the rule of the philosopher? Of course, philosophers will have to rule, and they have guardians who are heavily armed, but how will the philosophers become acceptable in the first place? So this is done by rhetoric, and therefore Thrasymachus, this very ambiguous character, plays a very great role in the Republic. Now, but what about the Protagoras? Now, the Protagoras, in contradistinction to its sister dialogue, the Gorgias, deals with sophistry and not with rhetoric. And this leads us to the suggestion that the true science of human things is a science of measuring pleasures and pains. One could say the philosophic calculus. But it is here, of course, the pleasures and pains of the individual, not of society at large. The power of the passion, that is indication, cannot be broken by mere persuasion, but only by an exact science. This will do what no persuasion can do. Now, whether that is a reasonable proposal or not, I think each of us must figure out themselves. Whether people, even if they know exactly the pain for which they with which they will be punished for a present pleasure, whereas now they do not have an exact relation. They cannot say it is 11 times greater, but only considerably greater. Whether this exact measurement will have any greater effect than the inexact statement, greater, you must be by yourself. So in the Protagoras, everything depends on the question, the political problem, which is no longer mentioned as such here. It depends on the possibility of this philosophic calculus in science. Now, what about the possibility of such a measuring art? First, do we know that it is possible? This was a question, not that addressed to the class. Do we know that it's possible? Why not? But we will investigate it on other occasions, that is so. And above all, however, if this possibility is tacitly questioned by Socrates' denying that virtue is teachable. If virtue were the figuring out what is the greatest pleasure, this figuring out could be taught, just as you can figure out length and as you can number the exact number of something. But the thesis of the Protagoras is truly that this figuring out is not only a condition of virtue, but it is virtue. Otherwise virtue wouldn't be knowledge. And we can safely say substitution of the philosophic calculus for virtue is not meant seriously by Socrates. Yes, and first one has to think about this. As ordinary human beings of some experience, as even the youngest of you are, what if you were confronted with a proposition that virtue is identical with the scientific calculus? What would you, as used here, what would you think? If you have that, you are a good man. If you don't have it, you are a bad man.
Virtue is a pretty low thing.
No, all right, maybe it is a low thing. This would not finish the argument. What is the obvious flaw of this thought?
Well, there are plenty of virtuous people,
What about anyone else has anything to say about them?
I think Protagoras makes the objection. He doesn't want to swallow the fellowship calculus. He thinks he has to hold out for the noble.
But on the other hand, Protagoras is not a very good witness because he ain't good at arithmetic. Or at mathematics.
But he may be good at knowing you were asking for publicly.
But what is the simple commonsensical objection if someone would say that?
Well, virtue would have to include as well as prudence, justice, which
wouldn't be accounted for. That is somehow implied. However, yes? All right, maybe, as some of these people say, what we ordinarily understand by virtue is just a phantom, a phantasm, and we shouldn't take it seriously.
But all right, then how much virtue is located in my habit?
But why not say it directly? Yes, you are right, but why not say it?
Virtue is, in calculating things, you can't simply have a slide rule because...
You cannot?
You can't simply have a slide rule because...
That is, of course, a deeper question regarding the fetishistic calculus itself. But the question, assuming that it were possible, could it be virtue? I believe one can say without hesitation, no, because we know so many people who know that this is harmful to them, whether they know it exactly or inexactly. And yet choose it. You know that this phenomenon of being overcome by present impressions, be they pleasures or fears, cannot be disposed of by this kind of reasoning. Now, what is the next point? What is the explicit argument of Socrates against Protagoras' claim, which claim implies the rejection of the art of measuring pleasure? Perhaps the sentence is fully phrased, and I'm almost certain it will put it. Protagoras' claim, as originally made, implies the rejection of the art of measurement. He doesn't even think of it. Otherwise, he couldn't have said virtue is something very different from knowledge. So if we turn then to Protagoras' original claim and forget about the art of measurement, what is the explicit argument of Socrates against Protagoras' claim? He is a man who raises a certain claim, interpreted by Socrates to mean that Protagoras claims to possess and to teach the political art or the political science. How does Socrates show that Protagoras doesn't possess that art?
He equates the good with the pleasant.
Socrates shows the way how you can make the equation of good with the pleasant stick to some extent. The whole tradition of hedonism is based on this. Exactly. And therefore he's finished. Yeah, or more precisely perhaps, what is the relation of virtue which is one, as Protagoras claims, to its part? He does not. But you are quite right. The simpler and clearer statement is Protagoras does not know what virtue is. How can he teach it?
Good.
Now, this much I wanted to say about, in a general way, just to loosen the ground a bit, to get the hard and fast into a more liquid condition. Now I would like to give a summary regarding the peculiarity of the Protagoras in contrasting it with the Gorgias. And if I omit something in my list, I would be very grateful to you if you would remind me of it. Perhaps it was implied in what I said, and if not, I have to add it. Now, the Gorgias clearly deals with rhetoric, whereas the Protagoras deals with sophistry is presented in the Gorgias as higher than rhetoric. But the theme of the Protagoras is not sophistry. The question, what sophistry is raised in the conversation with Hippocrates, as you may remember, but it is not answered because Hippocrates cannot answer it. It is not raised in the conversation with Protagoras at all. What Protagoras states about his claim, which Socrates then describes as a political art, is not sophistry. Perhaps it is an offshoot of sophistry. Perhaps we don't know, but it is surely not sophistry. We do not learn from the Protagoras what sophistry is. We see only a symptom because there are not more. So there is a certain imbalance then, insofar as the Gorgias very clearly discusses rhetoric, whereas the Protagoras does not clearly discuss sophistry. Now the second feature which I observe is that the Gorgias is a performed dialogue and the Protagoras is a narrated dialogue. Since the Gorgias is a performed dialogue, we do not know why Socrates sought the conversation with Gorgias beyond that Socrates wished to find out from Gorgias what he thought about rhetoric. But why? Picking Gorgias is no way enough. Whereas in the narrated dialogue Protagoras, we know why Socrates sought the conversation with Protagoras. Well, since you have read it as well as I did, why did Socrates seek the conversation with Protagoras?
Well, he was forced into it in order to dissuade to show with Socrates that it wasn't worth his while to study.
Yes. And began saying, in order to, with a slight acceleration, that Socrates tried to protect his progress against corruption. In the third item, which is already implied in this, to some extent in the second, is that the Protagoras is a compulsory dialogue. So it is compelled by Protagoras and by Hippocrates. And the Gorgias is very clearly, as you would see when reading the third page, a voluntary dialogue. So it is eager, spontaneously eager, to talk to Gorgias. The fourth item. There is, in the Protagoras, the discussions take place chiefly with the hero, if we call hero the man mentioned in the title. Whereas in the Gorgias, there is very little discussion with the hero, Gorgias. Now, if we try to understand that first in the head of Gorgias, we would see, by studying the Gorgias, that Socrates, who doesn't think highly of gorgeous rhetoric, silently suggests to this top rhetorician the highest purpose which his rhetoric serves. It would have to be, in order to be truly respectable, a rhetoric would have to be ministerial to virtue, which for Gorgias is not. But virtue is an enemy of philosophy, so it must be ministerial to philosophy. The discussion in the Gorgias takes place for the sake of Gorgias. He is to learn. There are quite a few passages in the latter half of the dialogue, especially in the Callicles section, when Callicles refuses to go on, and Gorgias insists, I want to hear. I want to hear. And similar amounts of story to do. In the Protagoras, on the other hand, Socrates openly suggests to Protagoras the true kind of sophistry, namely this felicity, what I call the felicity calculus. You remember, this ends, this is the way you have to argue, and in order to convince people that sophistry is good. He leaves it, however, doubtful whether this kind of knowledge or science is possible. The discussion in the Protagoras takes place for the sake of Hippocrates, not of Protagoras or any other sophist. And with this is connected the sixth difference. In the Protagoras, the discussion is not completed. It is clearly said at the end that they do not yet know the key point, whereas in the Gorgias, the discussion is completed. The myth is, in the case of the Gorgias, a clear sign that the discussion is completed. Now, number seven. In the Gorgias, the discussion of rhetoric, the subject matter is linked up with the question of Socrates' fate and his whole way of life. No such link up exists in the Protagoras. Since the Gorgias deals with the question of Socrates' fate, of his way of life, the question of the right way of life becomes a theme, and it's the eighth point. Socrates is presented as a defender of justice, moderation, philosophy. In the Protagoras, however, Socrates is not presented, and does not present himself, as a defender of justice and moderation. And connected with this is this point which is so crucial. In the Protagoras, he argues on the premise that the good is identical with the pleasant, which, as we know, leads to the art of measurement, in contradiction, measurement, but natural science, physics, physiology, the place is of course dropped. This is of no interest. Entirely different is the situation to Gorgias. The Gorgias, as a discussion, the Gorgias is based on the premise that the good differs from the pleasant. And this is connected with a sketch of a mathematical cosmology, as the historians would say, reminding of Pythagorean things and foreshadowing Plato's own time use. In the Gorgias, the need for a techne, a science or art, is traced to the fact, to the necessity of distinguishing between the good and the pleasant. Whereas the Protagoras is based on the premise, in the Gorgias, the premise is a good difference from the pleasant, and there is no art regarding the pleasant. No art. Which is a certain difficulty. Why should there not be an art of cookery, cooking, cookery, and there is no, this is at least a legitimate objection to Bhagavata. Whereas in the, yes, we need, according to the Gorgias, we need an art in order to distinguish between the good and the pleasant. And the good is not pleasant. Whereas the need for an art is traced in the Protagoras to the necessity of distinguishing between two kinds of pleasures, the preferable pleasures from those to be rejected. I come now to the next. Everyone reading the Protagoras, the beginning especially, must be struck by the fact that Sugares and Hippogres have such difficulty in getting into Kalyas' house where the Sophists are assembled. We shall say then, to generalize, the Sophists are difficult of access. And this difficulty is due to what? This difficulty of getting access to Protagoras and the others is due to what?
Well, the fact that sophistry is a dangerous profession.
Yeah, but more immediately. Huh?
Well, each man.
No, that is true.
The sophists stay in and the slaves despise them.
No, it's a eunuch. They can't get in because of the eunuch, but the eunuch is an enemy of the sophist. So the difficulty of access to the sophist is due to the enemies of the sophist, not to the sophist themselves. I mean, that we have no trace of that, yes?
Does that connect then up with their cause and the difficulty?
Yeah, I can't do that, but we have to proceed step by step. Incidentally, what about Sugares? Is access to Sugares difficult or easy? Very easy. In Plato, Sugares. What about the clouds? Does any one of you remember the clouds? Yes? A comical expression of the difference between Aristophanes Sugares and Plato's or Zenon Sugares is this, that Aristophanes Sugares, like a sophist, is difficult of access, and the Platonic Xenophontic Sugares is easy of access. Yes, indeed. Now, what about the Gorgias? Yes?
It occurred to me that in the topic of the unit, in the meeting of the door,
But this is, after all, he can't say, I can't let you in because I don't like you. After all, he is an employee. He has to give a reason, reflecting the master's opinion. That is not. But why does he say it? Because he regards him as a prophet.
Yes, but I was asking a question specifically
the access
to the
sophist.
When he asked to see Protagoras rather than
Callus,
the eunuch let him in.
Yeah, but not without without some grumbling. Yeah, that is still there. In the Gorgias, however, there is no difficulty of access whatever. Socrates is very conned by Callicles to this meeting with God. Now, at point number 10, which is in a way connected with, as Mr. Brill saw, with the last point. In the Protagoras, the hero claims to be frank. In the Gorgias, the hero does not raise his claim. He may be frank. People who don't raise the claim to be frank are more likely to be frank than others. And I have known people who, when you ask them for the time of the day, they might say, frankly, I do not know. And I have seen some of these people, they are very unfrank and they are very prodigal with the expression frank. That doesn't mean anything. So, but anyway, the undeniable fact is that Protagoras claims to be frank and Gorgias was not right to claim. And now the point which I will make is the last, 11th. Protagoras raises the exorbitant claim, exorbitant in the light of the end of the dialogue, to be a teacher of virtue. If provided you have the money and can pay for the instruction, you will become better every day you are with me. Gorgias does not raise this claim. We have here only not only the silence of Gorgias and the style of Gorgias, but in the Meno, there is a Meno, a pupil, or rather an adherent of Gorgias. It says, one more, 95b2c. So it's asked Meno, shall we say that the sophists are teachers of virtue? And Meno says, no.
No, no, Socrates, I assure you. Sometimes you may hear them refer to it as teachable, but sometimes as not. Then, are we to call those persons teachers of this thing when they do not even agree on that great question? I should say not, Socrates. Well, and what of the sophists? Do you consider these, its only professors, to be teachers of virtue? That is the point, Socrates, for which I admire Gorgias. You will never hear.
To a high degree, a matter of particularly. Yeah.
Particularly admire Gorgias. You will never hear him promising this, and he ridicules the others when he hears them promising it. Skill in speaking is what he takes it to be their business to produce. Then you do not think.
Yeah, that's all. So Gorgias has nothing to do with that exorbitant claim. This is like a much more sensible than he teaches rhetoric. Yes?
Well, in the Gorgias, he's led into that claim by Socrates, isn't he? And that's what brings about
it. Yeah, not quite. That is rather tricky. Socrates forces him to admit that. Socrates asks him, do you also teach that? He says, no, it's not rhetoric. And so they said, yeah, look, but if he is a crook, and then you give him this great weapon of rhetoric, then you will be held responsible for the terrible things he does with the art he learned from you. And Gorgias doesn't like that. And thereupon Gorgias says, well, they all come to me and know what just. But if they should not happen to know it, and in other words, if they are completely ill-bred dropouts, then I will tell them what the just thing. That's all. And this leads them to the service job. But he does not claim to make human beings better. Now, by raising this exorbitant claim, and it is exorbitant because he says, I'm much better than any Athenian. To be together, to spend your time with Pericles or with other elder statesmen is much less useful to you for becoming, possessing virtue, which includes, of course, political excellence, than to be with, to be together with such a stranger from southern Italy, or Sicily. Protagoras sticks his neck out by the fact of his claim. And therefore, the problem of concealment arises. Since it is dangerous, should he conceal his pursuit or should he not conceal? The problem of concealment does not arise for Gorgias, as we see from the silence of the Gorgias on this subject. And now we see this, and we have seen that Protagoras says, in contradistinction to all earlier sophists, he is the first who frankly admits to being a soul. And this frankness is the great thing. And this is in a way the most obvious difference between Socrates and Protagoras. That Socrates takes the side of the concealer. In other words, Protagoras has his intellectual ancestry. He gives a long list. Socrates gives a list of his intellectual ancestry in the Socrates section. Both, in spite of their opposition, the one is laconic, Socrates ancestry, laconic. And the other is non-laconic, because no one could say that Homer is laconic, for example. But both the laconic and the non-canonic, men are concealers. And Socrates agrees with both against this newfangled heritage. Protagoras, who says concealment is unnecessary. And this means, however, in the immediate context of the Protagoras, not in other contexts, that Socrates conceals his way of life, he conceals philosophy, that doesn't come up as such, and especially he conceals the opposition of the two ways of life, of the philosophic and non-philosophic, which is the key theme of the Gorgias. So this grand development of Socrates' way of life and its premises and consequences, this is wholly absent from the Protagoras. And he does he conceals, but at the same time he conceals the concealing by an extraordinary act. At the beginning, he tells this absolutely private affair which has taken place in the house of Callias. He tells the first comer who asks the welcome, "Would you like to hear this story?" Socrates says, "Please." He asks, he really requests them to listen. Also, you find no parallel to that in the other title. And of course, also, he publishes even the, what one may call, with a gross exaggeration, the bedroom scene, you know, when Hippocrates tells it and he tells it everyone. Good. Yes. Now, but the question which we should raise is this, regarding, since this concealment issue is, I believe, in no dialogue so patent as in Protagoras, is Protagoras truly frank, as he claims? We have some evidence for settling the question, but surely for articulating it. Yes?
Well, first of all, in his first speech about political art, which he claims to teach, I mean, he would appear not to be frank because he doesn't talk about those things which would give someone prominence in the city. He just talks about justice, moderation, and piety. And that's clearly not just the main body of his teaching, so he's not being frank there.
That is true. He is almost silent about his own art, which he employs in the case of his paying students. That's quite true, yes. But he speaks explicitly, even while raising the claim to absolute frankness, of the precautionary measures he has taken at the same time. In other words, his frankness is a measure of precaution. And therefore, the primary consideration is not frankness, but caution. Now, caution may also require some other means apart from caution. And furthermore, the initial scene, I believe I did not bring this out sufficiently, is that when Socrates and Socrates enter the building, they enter the house, and then they find three troops, Protagoras' group, Hippias' group, and Prodigus' group. Now, the only group where Socrates found out what they talked about was in the case of the Hebrew school, which was facilitated by the fact that they had mathematical instruments, but still he heard what they said. In the case of prodigals, they explicitly said they couldn't hear it because of the bad acoustics. But in the case of the Protagoras, it is not explicitly said, but suggested by the silence about it, that Socrates did not hear what Protagoras was telling to his group. Surely, Protagoras admits Pythagoras to being a sophist, but he does not, that this is his finding. He does not say that he has no secret teaching whatsoever. And we can even prove that he did not mean it by a very striking occurrence. How does he begin his exposition? With a myth. And the myth is not meant to be, of course, literally true. We have to translate it, and it is in this case very easy to translate it into non-mythical language. Yes. And the other adaptation to the Athenian democracy he made after having been warned by Socrates of the danger. So these were the main points I wanted to make. And I would like to add only one thing, rather with reference to future reading by yourself, or perhaps with me, or whatever may be the case. These two sister dialogues, the Protagoras and Gorgias, converge, you can say, toward an other dialogue. And this I know only since about a few days after, because I looked at the dialogue in question for a very long time. And that is the dialogue Meno. It is connected with the Gorgias by the very obvious fact that Meno is an adherent of Gorgias, and Gorgias is referred to, and with the Protagoras in a way more visibly by the fact, because this question is virtue knowledge, and is virtue teachable. The question which arose at the end of the Protagoras is three themes of the Meno. I mean, I'm not interested in the question in which sequence Plato has written the dialogue, which was the chief concern of classical scholarship in the 19th and early 20th century, and to some extent even now. I believe that is unimportant, because even if we knew by divine revelation when they were written, we cannot exclude by this that Plato might have conceived of them much earlier. I mean, Plato could have conceived of the laws, probably later, at the time he wrote the Republic, and simply said, I'm going to write this other book on second page, the law controls state, when I'm an old man, when I have in every way the qualities required for speaking about law, in which one should be one. I see no difficulty in that. And the same applies to all other considerations. That is, I mean, if you have the journal of a writer, the diary of a writer, and where in which he tells you, today this occurred to me for the first time, big day, as we know in other cases, for example of Nietzsche, we know of Kant, such great changes in his thought, and can date them. But we have no diary of this kind. We don't know everything. We have only the diary. And we have a lot of gossip, especially from later times, which is always interesting to hear, because it has at least the advantage of not being the brainchild of modern scholars. But of course, this is not sufficient, because there are many stupid people in classical antiquity. and therefore this is not. And so I think we have to try to understand the inner connection of the dialogue, regardless of any question of time when they were produced. When we looked at the beginning of the Protagoras, Socrates narrating the dialogue to someone named in a way, his proper name wasn't given, but he appears as a character called the comrade, and Socrates exchanges with him, Epirus. In the Republic, for example, Socrates also narrates, but we don't know to whom. It is a repair guess that the people to whom he narrates are the ones at the beginning of the Timaeus, Critias, and Hermocrates, but that doesn't appear from the title page of the Republic. But here we see the addressee, although nameless, but in a way identical, a nameless comrade. Now, this feature of the Protagoras links it up most directly with only one other Platonic dialogue, and that is the Euthydemus, where Socrates narrates a conversation, in this time to a named comrade, namely Criton, the hero of the Doric crest. You would see immediately when by reading the Euthydemus that the subject is very closely akin to that of the Protagoras, only much more obviously bantering, not to say frivolous. But still, there is also Socrates, the question of sophistry is on a much lower level, because Euthydemus and his brother, who are the heroes of this dialogue, are just clowns, whereas Protagoras cannot be called a clown in any condition. And there is another dialogue with which the Protagoras is obviously linked, and I mention this because reflection occurs in regarding every Platonic dialogue. You know, there are, say, 35 dialogues, and then there are, not every dialogue is directly linked to every other. There are families, so to speak. But this doesn't exclude that one member could not be left. Let us say nutrition, take it simply. Nutrition. But a stone and a mineral would not have nutrition, probably speaking. Yeah? So the stone does have inborn impulses, but not the inborn impulse about nutrition. That it has an inborn impulse is shown by the fact that it falls, if not supported. And there are others according to the peculiar character of the mineral in question.
So what distinguishes them then is inborn impulses of change of a certain kind.
Yeah. And you can say, they're both the highest and the lowest a natural being. With many special cases, would be locomotion. Because you have locomotion, a simple fall in heavy bodies, just the heavy body. And you have it again in the stars, which do not have growth nor qualitative change.
So it's
the
Greek word,
Amphitron Hermes. Amphitron Hermes.
The distinction between those natural things reproducing themselves is just, and those can't, just crucial here.
I don't get your question.
Between those things about nature which somehow
reproduce. No, not at all. He speaks of natural beings in general. And with the distinction between animate and inanimate, as Aristotle would say, empsicha and apsicha, does not come in here. That's the great theme of the book on the soul. But here he speaks of natural beings in general. And Mr. Kochner? The point is the essential reference to change. Yeah, I mean, if you speak of atoms and describe qualities of them,
whatever that may be. That would be insufficient from Aristotle's point of view, because you must also say which peculiar changes they are tending towards. Otherwise, that would be, you would not get at the heart of the matter. I mean, you can of course speak of a being and describe it, microscopic or macroscopic, and can describe it by its qualities and dispositions or what have you, but the core of the thing is that it is how it is related to change. You know, if, without it you wouldn't come to that point. Now let us go on and see how you can look at the material.
But insofar as they happen to be composed of stone or of earth or of a mixture of the two, they do have such an impulse. And just to that extent, which seems to indicate that nature is the source or cause of being moved and of being at rest in that to which it belongs primarily, in virtue of itself and not in virtue of a concomitant attribute.
So now he explains it. Exactly explains. So that is the first summary of what he means by species. A certain or this commanding origination and cause of motion and rest, in whom, in the being in which it is available, it is exists, primarily by itself and not by accident. And now he explains that.
I say, not in virtue of a concomitant attribute, because, for instance, a man who is a doctor might cure himself. Nevertheless, it is not insofar as he is a patient that he possesses the art of medicine. It merely has happened that the same man is doctor and patient, and that is why these attributes are not always found together.
So Aristotle is trying to give the pose of an easy misunderstanding. If nature is something like a physician healing himself, here the impulse towards healing is in the physician, and this affects the physician himself. He has the principle, the commanding origination of healing in himself. And Aristotle says that is an error, because the physician does not have his commanding origination in himself essentially, but only accidentally. Whereas in natural things, his commanding origination of change is essentially in the disease. The physician as physician heals or fails to heal. That is fundamentally the same thing. He is not essentially healing himself. That is by accident that he heals himself. Or perhaps, and that goes deeper, what does healing mean? Producing health. From this point of view, health is an artifact. Just health, the product of the physician, just as a bed is a product of the carpenter. But is this true? Is health an artifact, as bed is an artifact? Is health not a natural state of natural being, which is only assisted somehow by the medical art? Health is not man-made. It is essentially the work of nature. What the physician does is only subsidiary. But I think it is also important to consider at this point to consider that the physician healing himself is purely accidental. The physician as physician heals human beings, also. And whereas the healing stands there as one form of change, you see. The physician heals himself, the physician affects the change in himself, but he does not, that is only accidental. Now let us see how it goes on.
So it is with all other artificial products. None of them has in itself the source of its own production. But while in some cases, for instance, houses and the other products of manual labor, that principle is if something else external to the thing, in others,
those which may cause a change in the self in virtue of a concomitant attribute, they learn in the things themselves, but not in virtue of what they are.
And so that is, I think, refers back to the case of the decision. Yes? Yes?
Nature, then, is what has been stated. Things have a nature, which have a principle of their kind.
Yeah, which possess such a commanding origination. Those which do not, like the best, are not possess nature, are not natural. Yeah? Now then there comes a very difficult sentence which we will come back later on to read it on.
Each of them is a subject, or it is a subject, and nature always implies the subject in which it is here. The term according to nature is applied to all these things and also to the attributes which belong to them in virtue of what they are. For instance, the property of fire to be carried upward, which is not a nature, nor has a nature, but is by nature, or according to nature. What nature is, then, and the meaning of the term by nature and according to nature has been stated. That nature exists, it would be absurd to try to prove it. For it is obvious that there are many things of this kind, and to prove what is obvious by what is not is the mark of a man who is unable to distinguish what is self-evident from what is not. The state of mind is clearly possible. A man blind from birth might reason about color. Presumably, therefore, such persons must be talking about words without any thought to correspond.
In other words, someone to whom one has to prove that they are natural things is in the position of a colorblind man to whom you try to prove that they are colored. He simply could not understand what you are talking about. Yeah? He could talk about words and could somehow guess that a secondary consequence. For example, if he hears even people say this is this child has a blue face, that this means something different than if the child has a red face, and all kinds of alarms will come in the first case and not the second. But he really does not know and cannot know what they are talking about. And if someone tries to put it on other things, he is in the same position. Now a deeper reflection begins at this point.
Some identify the nature or substance of a natural object with that immediate constituent of it which, taken by itself, is without arrangement, e.g. the wood is the nature of the bed and the bronze the nature of the chapter.
Now, what is this switch? Now, Aristotle has now provisionally explained what natural beings are. More precisely, what beings are which are by nature. And these are beings which possess a nature, i.e. which possess a commanding origination of a change and the opposite of change in themselves as sensors. And now...